Every successful person got there by going through tough times. Success is a hard-ass teacher who likes to knock you around along that journey. You know, it takes real guts to not give up and keep going. We'll hear stories about failures and how these leaders flipped the script to create success. I'm John Schultz. Join me and let's discover how success is never really overnight. Welcome to the John Schultz podcast. Very excited about the guest I'm going to have today. Known him for a very long time. Good friend, golfing buddy. We both love golf. And it's Luis Massiani, who is the president of Webster Bank and COO of Webster Financial Corporation. Webster Financial Corporation is a leading commercial bank with more than $75 billion in assets. Amazing. He's also been chief operating officer, chief financial officer at Sterling Bank when they merged into this much bigger, broader bank, which is a great thing. Kelley School of Business at Indiana University, MBA, and avid golfer. And not only avid, he's good at it. Like that, not everyone could say that. So welcome, Luis.
Appreciate it, John. Thank you. It's been a long time coming, man. So happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, no, this is great. I'm very happy to have you, especially with what's going on in the banking industry. But we're going to start off, as we all know, you know, this podcast is on the myth of overnight success. And, you know, for a very young person, you've grown to a tremendous position in a gigantic industry. But to start off, I'd love to hear about, like, you know, how would your parents describe you as a kid growing up?
Yeah, no, thanks, John. That's, you know, again, thanks for having me. That's a great question. You know, I think that I've always, you know, the best thing or the easiest thing that characterizes me has always been that I've always been very kind of social. And, you know, it's, you know, my parents would have told you that growing up, I never had any issues making friends. I'm pretty, you know, kind of confident and comfortable and have always been in social settings. And so I've always gotten a tremendous amount of energy from hanging out with folks and with people in general. And so that's what, you know, they would tell you. Yeah, I was very, you know, I was probably too social and maybe didn't focus enough on school and schoolwork and that type of thing, because I was always out and about doing something different. And so, you know, it's been, you know, I don't think I've ever changed from that perspective, kind of the same types of things that I always, you know, the same types of things that I hear today from folks that get to know me about just being kind of open and easy to talk to and kind of easy to hang out with and so forth are kind of the same things from when I was a kid and all the way through high school and college and so forth. So it's, I guess it's been pretty good from that perspective.
Yeah. Well, I know you, and you've kept that going all the way up to this age, which is great. And where did you grow up when you were young?
Yeah, so I split time. So I was born in Caracas, Venezuela. And so my family's from South America. And so I split time between Caracas, Venezuela and Boynton Beach, Florida. So, you know, my family had, you know, a place in Florida when I was growing up. And so we used to spend about 4 or 5 months out of the year in Florida growing up. And then, you know, the remainder of the year in Caracas. So I went to school both in South America, so in Venezuela, as well as in, you know, in the States and so forth. And I finally moved full time to the States when I went to Valley Forge, Military Academy, to finish high school and start college. So my first year of college was actually there as well. So I kind of had, the best of both worlds from the perspective of, growing up in a dual speaking language household and, had the best of both worlds of being able to, you know, experience kind of South American and Venezuelan and kind of Hispanic culture. And then at the same time, you know, kind of growing up in the States. So it's been, it was fun and interesting to grow up with that type of dynamic.
I think that's terrific. So when you were younger, I mean, obviously, you said you went to this military academy, like, how did that shape your childhood, your growth? Yeah. Like, what direction did that put you on?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. That's a great question because, there was, one of the kind of funny, you know, stories that we always tell around as a family is that, I was, as I said before, you know, I wouldn't say that I was a problem child, but I certainly was not, as focused and as, motivated and as dedicated as I am today. And in large part, where I learned, the discipline and kind of effort and kind of focus of just, you know, kind of having a, almost a kind of myopic type of view of like, hey, once I want to do something, I'm going to go do it type thing and give 110% effort. That was from the 3 years that I spent at, in military school, where you get a very, very different, first and foremost, you're away from home. So you're not with your family, number one, because it was a boarding school. And so you kind of have to, you know, have a level of independence when you're in that type of setting. That is tough to do if you're kind of, living at home, especially at a pretty young age, because I went to school there when I was, 16, so 15, 16. So it was, pretty early on. And then second, that was a place where it was a pure meritocracy. Nobody did you any favors, right? And so you pretty quickly move away from, you're Gus and Olga's kid, which are, those are my parents' names, or you are this, you're his brother, or his sister, this person or that person. And you're kind of fending a little bit for yourself there. And whatever you achieve and whatever you get to is because you kind of achieved it on your own in a way, right? And so, that really put me on a very, very different trajectory, because it finally got me to, focus a little bit more on what was important, focus a little bit more on kind of having a clear path and clearer, because I wouldn't say that I have a clear path. I still think about many different things, but, a clearer path on what you wanted to do and how you wanted to go about doing it. And then most importantly, kind of hard work and effort, which, when I went from, we used to wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning to go do military drills and kind of, physical fitness type stuff. And your day would finish up at 10 o'clock at night with lights out. And let me tell you, it was pretty, even I was 17, 18, it was pretty tiring. I used to be, lights out was at 10 o'clock. I was out by 10:01. So it was good, hard work, discipline that, that got instilled in me there, which I kind of still to this day, I do the same things that I do before. I make my bed every morning. So that's from military school. I didn't do that before I went to military school.
There's a great book on that. I forget the author, but he had this unbelievable bestseller on the first thing you do in the morning is wake up and make
you
your
accomplish
bed.
Something. Yeah. Right. You accomplish something. You've done something that's positive for sure.
So, it's interesting. I think I've done so many podcasts now, how people remember certain challenging times that when they were young, that, those traits they brought through to their lives the whole way through. Is there anything that would you say was your biggest challenge, maybe while it was there or something after that, that occurred that you could remember that sort of shaped you for where you are today?
Yeah. Wow, man. That is, that's a great question. I'd say that there have been, from the perspective of things that I would say have really put me on a, on a different trajectory. So first and foremost, I always got, always had tremendous inspiration from my mom in particular, because she was, in Venezuela, so when we were growing up in the 1970s, early 80s in Venezuela, it was a, very male dominated culture, which it still is today in many parts of Latin America still are. But my mom was the first partner at a law firm in Venezuela, first female partner, sorry, as, first woman partner at a law firm in Venezuela. And she was, well ahead of her time from the perspective of, being kind of the only woman in the room when there was, everybody else around her was, kind of men and so forth. And, seeing her kind of achieve the things that she did and the hard work that she did and the, how she went about from the perspective of not minding what people would tell her or kind of how people would dismiss her and so forth because she was a woman in those types of settings, was always, truly, inspirational. So that wasn't a challenge so much in my life, but it was certainly a challenge that I saw. That I said, if you actually put your mind to something, it's like, even you can break down some pretty significant barriers. And she broke down some pretty significant barriers when she was kind of going up the corporate ladder and kind of doing all the things that, that she was able to achieve. I'd say that similarly to that, even though I went to a very good school, I owe a lot of my education and kind of all the things that I learned at Kelly and at Indiana. That was not a, and again, this is, I want to put this as a big challenge, but, being able to, kind of parlay and go from, that school environment into the worlds of where I actually started my career on Wall Street and so forth was not the easiest thing to do, at that time. So I started in 1998, early 2000s, when the vast majority of folks that were on Wall Street. And, you know, this has changed a lot in kind of, you know, in more recent times. But back then, everybody was Ivy League educated, right? And so, you know, the first analyst class that I joined, sorry, the first analyst and associate classes that I joined when I first started my career, you know, you would look at the roster of folks that was there, and where there'd be 100 analysts and, you know, 100 associates, and every single person had next to their name, you know, Princeton, Dartmouth, Harvard, Cornell, NYU, you know, and so just rattle off the schools of, you know, the Ivy Leagues and kind of the highest of, you know, and then you'd get to kind of my name, Luis Massiani, and it'd say, you know, Indiana and Stetson University, where I got my undergrad, and it stuck out like a sore thumb. And, you know, again, it was a little bit of a challenge in the sense of, first and foremost, to get a foot in the door. You know, when I was going through the interview processes and so forth, I got a lot of quizzical looks as to like, hey, we don't hire folks from, you know, with, you know, from that academic background. Again, good schools. It's not that the schools were bad. It's just that it was a, you know, a little bit of a, you know, kind of a hoop that you had to jump through, a little bit of a barrier that it had, because historically folks did not, you know, join Wall Street coming from, you know, from the, you know, from that type of academic background. And, you know, I got to give a lot of kudos and credit to a couple of the folks that believed in me when I first came through the ranks, when I joined, you know, specifically Bear Stearns in 2002. Where for me, that was the best type of firm that I could have ever joined, because that was truly a meritocracy. You know, so, you know, at Bear Stearns, you, yeah, it, maybe it mattered where you went to school, but once you were in the door at Bear Stearns, nobody cared where you had, you know, nobody cared what your name was, who you were, who you knew, what your name, you know, where you went to school, what types of degrees you had. You could either perform or you couldn't. And if you could perform, you had, maybe you didn't even have a college degree. And, you know, we had folks that Bear that had gone from the mailroom to the boardroom type thing. And I loved that type of environment and culture. And so that was kind of finding the right place at the right time for me, because I found a couple of folks that said, hey, you know, this kid could come from anywhere. It doesn't really matter. Seems like he's a smart guy. You know, let's give him a shot. And you know what? It was, a, you know, it that was very clear when I was going in that they said, hey, you have a pretty short leash. So you better work really, really hard. And, you know, listen, from the first year that I was there going forward, I was always, now I wouldn't say that I was the top of my associate classes, or I wasn't like the top guy, but I was always very much a top, you know, kind of a top performer and so forth. And it was, again, it was the challenge of getting your foot in the door, but then taking the, you know, taking the kind of the grabbing the bull by the horns and making the most of the opportunity once you were in, which is what.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm listening. So, you know, you saw your mother. So when you got out, you sort of lived the same thing in your mind with what the college issue was, right?
100%.
You know, you had a meritocracy when you were younger, so you went into a firm that sort of acted like that, so you were familiar with that feeling, right? But you didn't plan any of it.
Yeah,
it sort of happened because, you know, you kept moving forward, and you're a guy that, you know, is charging forward and trying to figure things out, right? Which you're great at. So I find that so interesting that we don't realize, like, what, as we're younger, affects us and how we end up where we end up.
100%.
Without even a plan. It just sort of, it comes, and then we can handle it because we had all those great experiences.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're at Bear Stearns. What made you like finance? Because at the end of the day, I know, you know, in that era, everyone sort of thought they wanted to be on Wall Street, but that most or not a lot of them stayed with it. Like, what was finance for you?
Yeah. So, that's, you know, that certainly is not the case anymore. Back then it was, you know, I was purely driven by the fact that that was, if you were good with numbers and you liked finance, then you had to, in some way, shape or form, you had to, you know, land on, you know, in Wall Street. And so that's what kind of got me first interested in it. I was always very good quantitatively, you know, technically, you know, I was a finance and accounting major, you know, both minor and major in both, you know, undergrad and in grad school. I was, I'd say, an average student at best when it came to things like, you know, marketing and some of the more qualitative types of aspects of, you know, business schools and so forth. And so I naturally always gravitated towards places where I thought professionally I was going to be able to use the, you know, kind of the finance background and technical skills that I'd kind of built up and that I'd learned about, you know, in school. But at the same time, as I said before, I was also pretty, you know, social, you know, person growing up and still was throughout college and grad school and so forth. And so, you know, when I jumped into the world of investment banking, it was really the, you know, I guess I'd call it the best of two worlds or a combination of both, right? Because in the initial parts, the initial stages where you're an analyst and an associate in investment banking, you're literally behind the scenes working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, building financial models, preparing presentations, you know, kind of thinking about ways to present things and so forth, and kind of distill complex data and present it in a way that's going to be simple and kind of concise and straightforward for, you know, for people to digest. And so I was pretty good at that. I'd say I was really good at it. And so that was the first 3 or 4 years that that I worked on Wall Street. It was really very much focused on kind of behind the scenes, you know, financial analyses, you know, preparation of presentations and kind of distilling of, you know, kind of helping others try to create information for them to be able to present, you know, transactions, ideas, strategies and so forth. But the interesting thing about that world is that you pretty quickly have to migrate from not just being a behind the scenes person, but also being, you know, somebody that can go out there and kind of, you know, present to clients, communicate with clients, build relationships with clients. And that's where I'm really good at. And today, I think, you know, John being, you know, the good working relationship that we have as well, I think that you would probably be a good, you know, kind of a good person to ask, you know, how I go about doing that, of just building relationships with folks and kind of understanding how to, you know, how to, you know, kind of, you know, help and advise and consult, but at the same time, not overpower, not overburden, you know, kind of folks that.
Yeah.
You know,
and how important, like, to you, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think people don't realize how important and integral, and they don't like to say the word, sales is.
Yeah.
And learning how to build relationships. So it's really, yeah, doesn't even feel like a sale. It's more of a collaboration. How important is it to learn the networking, building relationship skills to achieve success? Yeah.
100%. It is critical. It is absolutely critical. And, you know, one of the things that I pride myself on, I went back when I was at in my Citigroup days, I actually did a, you know, kind of, you know, a training program that was called Spin Sales, which, you know, actually focused on demonstrating to folks in any business, really. It was obviously financial services focused because it was, you know, I was at Citigroup at the time. But this could have applied to any industry, right, which is, you know, there's two types of industries. There's product pushing and then there's relationship building. And when you're in a product pushing business, then you have to focus on the product. You have to build that. You have to build the best product that you can, understand all the features about it. And then, you know, that's like selling a car. Hey, it's got this feature, that feature. And that's in the product pushing business. But if you're in a relationship based business, which financial services and banking certainly is, the worst thing that you can do is to become a product pusher, right? You know, I do not, you know, I've always prided myself on not telling you, hey, I've got this product or I've got this service. This is, you know, you have to use it because of XYZ, but rather have it be something that we collaborate on to figure out, like, what are the pressure points? What are the things that you're trying to solve as you think about your business or you think about your company? What are the issues that you're facing? Like, what are the, and so many times, you know, financial services, relationship managers and bankers will fall into the trap of saying, hey, I want to sell you a loan, without knowing if the company needs that loan or not, versus, you know, getting to know somebody to understand, hey, like, what's the issue with your business? Hey, I'm not turning working capital fast enough. And so therefore, you know, I have to, you know, take down more loans than I want to, which is eating into my profitability. That's very different from me trying to sell you a loan than from you telling me that you have a working capital issue. And then what are the types of products and services that I can offer you to essentially make that better for you from how you essentially kind of help you manage your business, not me force products and services on you, onto your business. And so I'd say that that has been the, you know, kind of the number one, you know, kind of the ability to kind of sit, you know, to not just sell, but to sit down with somebody, understand what they're, you know, kind of what they're looking for, what their issues are, and then not immediately jump into trying to sell you something, but rather collaborate on what is, you know, truly important and impactful for your business is the single biggest skill that you can have. Because if you turn yourself from a, you can always be a salesman, but if you turn yourself into a trusted advisor and a trusted consultant, or you turn yourself into somebody that has the ability to, that people want to come back to you for repeat business.
It's trust.
That's the secret to success.
All trust.
It's all about building trust.
Building
it's about
trust.
People understanding that you're not there trying to get something to your advantage, but you're actually trying to get to a compromise or a collaboration where both people benefit on what you're trying to do. And that is the single biggest thing that you can, the best and single biggest thing that you can do is build trust to become a trusted advisor.
And you've been amazing at it. And I can say that firsthand knowing, but what's very interesting about you, I mean, you're a very young president of a very large bank. you know, you've had many roles in your career, like Bear Stearns, Citigroup, you know, all the way back to, you know, Provident Bank in Washington when you first started. So you've been in the finance business for a while. Being so young and having such a gigantic role in lots that's gone on from mergers, you know, how does it feel? How do you build trust being that you're probably younger than most people you're dealing with in the banking industry because it's an older industry?
Yeah.
And what are some of the challenges you faced being so young, even though you've been in it a long time? And this didn't happen overnight, which obviously is the name of this podcast, right? Myth of Overnight Success. But how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, that's, you know, the first great example that I can give you when, you know, when I became the CFO of Provident New York Bank Corp, which happened in 2011, I was 36 at the time. And Provident New York was a relatively small bank. It was $3 billion in assets, $200 million in market cap. And so when that opportunity was presented to me, it was a pretty significant change from going from being a kind of Wall Street investment banker, which, you know, best decision that I ever made was leaving that to do what I'm doing now. But, you know, hindsight being 2020, it was a tough decision because I had always worked at very large organizations. This opportunity presented itself with somebody that I knew very well, who was our CEO at the time, Jack Kopnisky, who's still a, you know, great, great friend and a mentor. You know, kind of going from large corporate to a very, very small, you know, community-based bank in Montebello, New York, which is, you know, an hour and a half away from, you know, from New York City, was a pretty significant leap. And I'll never forget that when Jack first brought me in, he wanted me to meet a couple of, you know, board members. And when I walked into the room and they saw me, they were like, "How old are you?" That was the first question that they asked me. And I said, "I'm 36. They're like, "You don't look 36. You look like you're 22. And I was like, "Oh, well, I can assure you I'm 36. And it was interesting because at the time, the vast majority of bank CFOs had a very specific, you know, similar to what I said before regarding when I first got into Wall Street. You had a specific background that people followed. You know, it was very different also when I first joined Provident New York Bank Corp, because the vast majority of bank CFOs, especially of banks of that size, were CPAs, which I was not, had some sort of experience in public, you know, kind of in public accounting, most of them from, you know, Big Four accounting. You know, if you were to go poll bank CFOs of banks under $50 billion in assets, 95% of them have worked at KPMG, Deloitte, Ernst & Young. It was a very specific, and it was a very specific role that those types of CFOs present, which is they are more a kind of accounting, finance, treasury-focused CFO versus, you know, strategy, M&A, corporate development type of CFO, right? And so I'm sitting there in this room, you know, getting interviewed by two of our kind of our lead director and our head of the audit committee. And, you know, the first question they asked me is like, "So what experience do you have doing taxes?" And I was like, "I have no, other than my personal income taxes, I have no experience doing taxes." And they're like, "Oh, wow, that's interesting. And then are you a CPA?" I was like, "No, I'm not a CPA." And so they kind of continued to that this line of questioning as if I was a traditional CFO of a bank of that size, until after like about 10 minutes of questioning, I kind of say, "Hey guys, let's take a 20-second time out because I can tell that you're kind of scratching your head as to what I'm doing here." And so I said, "Listen, I'm not the smart, you know, I'm not a CPA, I'm not a tax guy, but I'm pretty smart and I'm going to figure all those things out. And to the extent that I don't know what I'm doing there, I'm going to find somebody who does and I'll hire them and so forth. But you're not hiring me to be a controller. You're not hiring me to be a finance guy who's essentially kind of, you know, kind of recording numbers and putting the entries into systems. That's not what I do. I've never done that before. You're essentially hiring me, and Jack's hiring me to essentially help him build this company into something different." All right. And so, you know, from that point forward, the nature of the conversation, that meeting and going forward changed pretty substantially. But it was, you know,
what gave you the courage? Because it sounds good, right? And you're in there, but you still have to have the courage to still feel and be you. Like, where do you think you can draw from that in your past or your experience?
You know, I'd say that the, you know, I always had, I was always very open-minded from the perspective of knowing that I, you know, that I don't know everything. I know that, right? I know what I know. I don't know what I don't know. But I've always had a substantial amount of, I can understand enough and have enough common sense to, and I'd say this, I have never been somebody who, I will never let a topic go until I understand it, right? I'm the type of person who I've never been afraid to look like a fool in front of, I guess I'm afraid of looking like a fool in front of a lot of people, but I've never been afraid to look like a fool in front of somebody when I ask them a question and they act and they respond something back, or they give me an answer and I don't understand it. I'll be upfront. I was like, I don't understand it. Maybe I'm not smart enough to understand this topic, but we're not leaving this conversation until I understand what you're telling me.
Right. So instead of letting it go,
right.
And
I have the confidence to say, like, you know what? I'm there. You too many times you run into folks that will ask a question, get an answer. They still have no idea what the issue is, but they are afraid. They're not confident enough in their own skin, I guess, or in their own capabilities.
So I always say asking for help or not knowing is a superpower.
Superpower.
Because, like, you're not supposed to know everything. And the more we realize that we learn from not knowing and is a power. It's a strength, not a weakness.
I've always been much more interested in joining a meeting or attending a meeting where I have absolutely no idea about the subject matter, and then just sitting there and peppering people with questions and asking the same question 10 times until I fully understand it. And then also having other folks on my team join. So I've always prided myself on having folks on my team that actually are different than I am and know different things than I do, so that you can essentially then have a very, you know, kind of, you can have a balanced view of what yep. to do, how to think about things, where to take things and so forth. But it really, you'd be surprised at how many times I've come across my career folks that just are afraid to ask. And I've always been, no, it's like, I'm going to continue asking you questions until I understand what you're saying. And at some point I'm going to finally come to a conclusion that either you don't know what you're talking about because you can't explain it to me.
Right.
Or that, yeah, maybe I am not smart enough to figure out what this person is saying, but I've actually never landed into the, oh, I'm not smart enough to understand it. Finally.
I love that.
I have landed many, many times like, oh, this person actually doesn't know what they're talking about.
Which so would you say that's your, like, you know, you're approachable because of that, right?
Yes.
And also you get to learn and grow as a leader.
Absolutely.
Because you're not worried about what someone thinks and what you know or don't know. You're learning as you go. I love it. So with knowing that you had this gigantic merger of Sterling and Webster, how would you say you measured your success so far with having such a key role?
Yeah.
You know, we talked about how young you are, but still, like, you've been in the business for a long time. How do you measure your success?
Yeah, I think the, you know, listen, in our, you know, when I think about what we set out to do when I first joined in 2011, you know, our idea was to essentially build, you know, that first legacy bank, Provident New York Bank Corp, into a, you know, from 2 or 3 billion in assets to 10 billion in assets. And then we were going to essentially turn around and sell it, right? So from the perspective of what this has become in the last 11 or 12 years relative to where we thought we were going to build, this has been, you know, an epic success, right? You know, this is bigger, more complicated. So this is bigger, more complex, more profitable, more interesting, more fun than anything that we ever thought that we were going to do, right? And so from that perspective, I'd say that has, you know, from a financial performance perspective, from an operating perspective, it's been a tremendous, you know, tremendous success. I take it, you know, kind of, I think about this, you know, differently in the sense that for me, the last 12 years have been super interesting because we've done, you know, we've done all kinds of things from the perspective of buying and selling companies, buying and selling portfolios, getting in and out of businesses, having a very a constant and ongoing pragmatic view of the world of, you know, and taking great pride in never having sacred cows and essentially saying, you know what, every day is a new day. You know, things change. We've been in businesses forever, but that doesn't mean that we're going to be in those businesses tomorrow. And so we, you know, one of the things that I consider to be a real unmitigated success is that we've built a team of people that is kind of all thinks about the world that way. Right. Which is, you know, we don't, you know, we agree, we disagree, we, you know, we debate. But everybody is very, very comfortable kind of realizing that, you know, just because we're doing something today doesn't mean we got to do it tomorrow. And, you know, having that type of mentality and that type of culture in an organization is super, super fun to be around. because every day that you walk in here, I walk in every day, I don't know what's going to happen. And that goes back to when I was in, you know, where I really in the world of investment banking prepared me very well for to doing that, because in investment banking, you never knew what was going to pop up that day, right? It could be, you know, all of a sudden there was a, you know, takeover defense that you had to do because a client was, you know, had received a, you know, kind of a takeover offer, or the next day you were doing something. You had to essentially get comfortable with, first and foremost, getting pulled in a million different directions. And second, you had to get comfortable with uncertainty, which is something that people really, really struggle with, right?
It's amazing. Yeah. Like, if I could go back and listen to every podcast again that I've done, which is now almost 60, there's not one person that has not felt what you just felt and said what you just said, that most of their career and most of the things they go through, they never knew, they felt uncertain, and they had to be open-minded and get comfortable with that. And like, if you just were taught that in school, like a whole course on, and you sort of did it by going to that military. I mean, like you put yourself there, however you got there. It happened to you at an early age, and it's really at a you're so young for what you've accomplished. Like, if people would just understand that as part of the training of being young, it's just, you're not in control of anything. You never know, and get good with it.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's about, and I'm sure that in your other 60 podcasts, they would tell you the same thing, which is you never know where opportunity is going to come from. And, you know, this, you know, when I first when I first made the transition from, you know, from Wall Street to the CFO role, it was completely, you know, I wasn't looking for it. I was, you know, I was sitting in my office one day at 11 Madison Avenue. And, you know, this guy that I mentioned before, Jack Kopnisky, calls me up and he's like, hey, man, I really need your help. And I was like, what do you need? And I thought that he was going to ask me for, hey, I need a line of credit, or I need advice on an M&A deal or something like that.
Or I needed a good member guest golf partner.
Yeah, I got to force him this weekend and I need somebody to join. And, you know, out of the blue, he's like, hey, I need you to join as my CFO. And I was like, what do you mean, Jack? And, you know, and I was like, I had never even thought about it. And, you know, I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that that's what you were going to call me. Let me go home and think about it. And I'll come back to you early next week. And you know, I went home and I thought about it. And I was like, hey, you know what? This is different. Sounds interesting. I've always, you know, kind of always liked Jack. He's a great guy. We've known each other for a long time. He's a go-getter. He's got great ideas. You know, this could be interesting.
And you weren't afraid to try again.
You weren't afraid to try. Yeah. And it was a pretty significant change. It was, you know, it was a small company. It was, it was a big transition for me from a professional perspective too, because I was used to a very different work environment than, you know, corporate America is not built equally, you know, depending on industry sectors and size of companies and so forth. And so that was also a pretty, you know, pretty big and significant change. But, you know, going back to what we said before, it was uncertainty, but, you know, confidence in my ability to build relationships, confidence in my ability to be able to parachute into this. Like, when I first joined there, like, people thought that I was an extraterrestrial. It's like, who is this guy? I was young. I was a very different background. I spoke differently. I focused on different things. I kind of managed, you know, businesses, you know, meetings differently. It's like, folks, when I first got to private, it was like, oh my God, like, where did this guy come from? What is he like? Where is he going to take us and so forth? What is he going to do? And, you know, kind of, again, it's you jump in, you show people what you can do, that you're going to work hard, that you're smart, you kind of.
Well, you're in it. You get in with that. And listen, you could not scale, merge, and keep a culture as well as you've done.
Yeah.
If you didn't have all those attributes, so kudos to you. So here we are. You're now obviously where you are today. You know, we're in this world where obviously rates have been rising as fast as we could possibly imagine, at least in my lifetime. Yeah, it's never gone so fast and furious. So, you know, and we are where we are today. So where do you see the challenges and opportunities moving forward with sort of the banking system and, you know, where we are with rates?
Yeah. You know, listen, I think it's a, you know, that's a question that we, you know, talk about and debate internally here, you know, pretty much every day. That's a large part of what I get paid to do nowadays. It's interesting, you know, the mid-sized, the sector in general, and particularly the mid-sized bank sector where we are now today, and mid-sized banks, well, you know, defined as, you know, kind of $10, $20 billion in assets all the way up to about 150 or 200 billion. So it's a pretty, you know, pretty significant, you know, kind of bucket or group of banks that still exist in that size threshold. You know, we went through a pretty, you know, I guess I'd call it, I went through the third end of the world type of dynamic in my financial services career in March of this year when we had, unfortunately, three of the mid-sized banks, you know, kind of disappear by and getting taken over by the regulators. And, you know, that always, you know, it's interesting to me because it's like, you know, the world of financial services and learning in financial services is always, you know, cyclical. It's not linear. It's like we don't build, you know, the same mistakes that we make in the past or the same mistakes the financial services businesses make over and over again. And unfortunately, the immediate tendency and reaction from the powers that be, you know, regulators and politicians and so forth is to essentially do the same thing, which is continue to hammer and double down on, oh, banks need more capital or banks need more regulation or banks need more this, banks need more that. And the you know, kind of the interesting thing is that the, you know, what happened in March of this year with those three banks disappearing had nothing to do with capital, had nothing to do with, you know, increased regulation. It was just, you know, kind of mistakes that, you know, banks made in positioning their balance sheet and unfortunately getting caught sideways. But that's what's done in every bank in the history of the world, right? Every time that a bank has had, there's been a banking crisis, it's been kind of the same type of dynamic. And it doesn't get solved by telling banks to add more capital of this or adding more of that and so forth. It truly goes back down to having good seasoned, you know, management teams that, that build kind of well-diversified, well-funded, well-balanced, well-balanced balance sheets. And kind of the things that can essentially over time withstand any type of interest rate dynamic. So what you just described today, yes, rates have gone up tremendously. Some banks were well positioned for it. Some banks were not. But the banks that have the kind of a balance to their business and diversification to their business don't really care if rates go up or down. We do care, you know, you do care eventually on an absolute basis if rates go up and down. But if you have a good business, regardless of what rates do, you can make money in the banking business, right? And so it always goes back to, it always goes back to good senior, good management of risks and of identifying, you know, kind of potential issues that might lie in other areas. But it's a, you know, the risks that we run today are the risks that we've always had and we always will in the bank business.
You know, it was scary. I mean, we all felt that for those couple weeks. Like it was, you know,
yeah,
the whole, you know, not knowing where anything was in banking at that moment. Is there any regulatory or compliance changes or challenges that have affected you since then? Or how do you see that going?
Yeah, you know, I think that as I said, you know, a little bit of what I was talking about before, the immediate reaction as or the counteraction or the action that always gets taken when the sector goes and when the banking sector goes through something like we did in March is always to come down with increased regulation, always to come down with increased capital requirements. And that's going to happen. You know, there's it's ongoing right now with proposals presented by the Fed and the OCC and the FDIC that are out for comment periods right now and so forth. And so at some point in the next, 12 months or so, you are going to see, banking, rules and regulations get a little bit tougher. It's going to come down to banks, no doubt the new size threshold and kind of where those new regs are going to, come into is more than likely going to be $100 billion in asset size. So even though we are below that threshold, we manage to them already because, folks, if you're a company like us that continues to grow and that.
Yeah, you want to grow. You want to grow. Yeah. You want to be ready when you grow into these things, right?
You have to, 100%. And you can't, as a publicly traded company, you can't put out there something saying that, oh, we're not going to grow. And we're going to stay below that threshold. That's not, that wouldn't be good for our employees and for investors. Yeah. Like, people want you to be ready to take on the challenges of being able to run a business that continues to grow. And so, we've always viewed it. It's interesting because we have always viewed increased regulation as actually an opportunity for us because we think that we are better than most. And so to the extent that there's going to be things that make it tougher for, management teams to manage their business, we actually see it as an opportunity. And so if you think about it from that perspective of maybe looking at the silver lining of like, hey, yeah, there's going to be more capital requirements or hey, there's going to be more liquidity and funding requirements. But if you're, you know, if you're a good, astute management team that knows what you're doing, you can actually use that to your advantage to either buy things, look at things, get into new businesses.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, you know, you adapt or
you adapt.
Won't be here.
If you're better at adapting than others, as things change, then it creates opportunity. There's no doubt.
Great. So I know you're a technology focused person. You've always been. Where do you see AI? I mean, you know, we're early, just like when the internet first started. But where do you see AI and technology maybe helping that role of creating efficiency? So all these different regulations or whatever you have to work under can maybe be a smoother, easier thing for everyone to not have those things happen again.
Yeah, no, that's... We spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about how we're going to use technology to do what we do today better and to actually do, use it as an offset for, you know, everything that comes down on us from a regulatory perspective or from an increased capital perspective. All it does is it increases cost for us. And, you know, using it, you know, using technology both from the perspective of kind of, artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics, you know, anything that allows you to essentially create an environment in which you can offset some of that costs are things that we're focused on. Now, the bigger, you know, the way that we think about it, though, is not so much about, taking existing costs out of the company. What you're going to essentially go build a, through AI, a kind of a robot that essentially allows you to, reduce headcount in our anti-money laundering business or in our risk and compliance areas and so forth, you know, that in and of itself is not going to result necessarily in a cost save or in a reduction in operating expense because building that technology is very expensive. But what that technology build allows you to do is that it allows you to scale at a substantially more attractive, price point or a substantially more attractive kind of marginal return on that incremental dollar of growth that you're putting onto your balance sheet, right? And so we don't think about the world as technology necessarily within the constructs of our company today as a $75 billion in asset size bank. We think about it as, oh, let's invest in the technology that's going to allow us to take this bank from $75 billion with a $1 billion expense base to $150 billion with a $1.5 billion expense base, right? It's that concept of essentially investing in technology, predictive analytics. Well, predictive analytics is slightly differently. In the investment in technology from an OPEX perspective, it's more about creating operating leverage of being able to put a fixed investment in that's going to allow us to grow that marginal dollar at a substantially more attractive profitability profile to us than if we continue to just add people to the mix and so forth.
And how close are we? I mean,
we're very close to
the cloud. We are set up for success right now in my mind for this.
Yeah. So we are, eliminating, so first and foremost, the move to the cloud by eliminating of the need for physical data centers and co-location facilities and having to add more servers and so forth every time that you essentially grow and buy something. That, you know, those are perfect examples of places where technology exists today that if you are successful in migrating to it, creates the dynamic for being able to grow substantially more, to scale and grow at a substantially better price than what you could do if you were not doing those types of technologies, right? So that is absolutely right. The ability to essentially get your customers to essentially interact and transact with you through digital channels is another perfect example, right? So the more folks that I have using our mobile applications, both on the commercial and consumer side, where they essentially can self-serve themselves, right? Because you've created the dynamic for them to do every single product or service that they can either off their phone or through their computer. You know, that's been alive and well for a long period of time, but we're finally getting to the point where you have that inflection point of consumers and commercial clients that are more comfortable using the digital channels than folks that were not before. And so that, I believe, is a big inflection point that's coming to the industry, which is for these products and technologies and tools
adoption
have existed for a long period of time, but they have not been fully adopted because you still have in this country a substantial amount of payments, for example, going via check, which makes absolutely no sense. We're the only country in Europe, nobody pays in a check in Europe anymore, right? right? Nobody, like many countries in Europe, have moved to cashless. You know,
when I need to write, I have trouble finding my checks when I need to write a check.
I always like to tell people I work at a bank, but I haven't set foot in a bank branch in 15 years, other than to visit, you know, our.
Yeah, of course. You got
to
visit.
Other than to visit our branches, but I actually have not conducted business from a transaction activity in a branch. And you're finally getting to a place where the cohort and population of commercial and consumer clients is actually getting there to be more comfortable with digital channels than what we've had before. So the composition and the profile of our client base is changing pretty substantially.
And COVID helped that, right? Because it forced everyone. It's amazing how things end up really happening.
Forced people to move to mobile. Yeah. It forced people, I don't want to open up a check because it might have COVID on it type thing. So people stopped doing that as well. But more interestingly too, I think, you know, the place where we have not, where we've started to think about, but haven't broken real ground yet is on predictive analytics and using machine learning to, you know, we've spent a tremendous amount of time and effort over the years in building a substantial amount of just getting access to really good data and trying to understand and kind of getting access to insights as to what happened historically or why something happened. The next iteration is essentially using those same building blocks to now figure out like what's going to happen in the future. Right.
That will be amazing, right? Because that'll give you insight.
If I can tell you 6 months in advance as a branch manager, it's like, hey, you know, that client is going to leave 6 months from now because of the profile of transaction activity that you might be seeing, or, you know, any other, you know, kind of access to data, you know, how they're using their debit card or for whatever reason, right? If you're essentially, we have as a bank, we have millions upon millions and hundreds of millions of data points that we can draw insights from. And so we have, historically, it's been more forward-looking. It's been more backward-looking than forward-looking. That's where the world of data insights.
It's got to learn what use case. Like you just got to decide what you want to learn, machine learn, and then what insights you think you need and test. And it's going to be so much fun and interesting next 5 years with all that capability actually becoming affordable with the computing power, just like how we store data. And all these tools that, you know, everyone's going to start focusing on point solutions for every industry, right? That'll be helpful. So my last question, you know, I always like to ask like an out of the box question. So what would be the most unconventional and unexpected skill or experience you possess that's positively impacted your career?
Wow. Skill. That's a good one. That's a really good question, Johnny. You got me thinking on that one. I'd say one of the things that I always hear, like whatever we're big in the company about doing, like 360 feedback reviews where everybody kind of your manager, your peers, your folks that report to you and so forth. That, like we're big on doing that. We do it like twice a year. And we've been doing it forever. I guess we've been doing it for about 12 years now since I joined Provident. And I think that the one thing that that has always surprised me that, you know, that kind of pops up in every one of these reviews has historically been that, you know, people either it's just perception, but it might be reality is that folks believe that I don't take myself too seriously. And I think that that's allowed me to essentially create don't take myself too seriously. I'm very relatable. And
yeah, people that you're easy to get to know.
Easy to get to know.
Like you're going to learn about people faster.
You learn about people faster. And I tell you that the biggest, I think that the biggest reason that's a really good skill is that I always like to say it's like it's very difficult for me, for John Sewell, our CEO, for Jack Hopnisky, our executive chairman. It's like, you know, good news goes up the chain of command very quickly. Right. It's like everybody wants to deliver good news to me. Everybody wants to deliver good news to our CEO. It's like, oh, we did this, we did that. But nobody ever wants to tell you bad stuff. Right. And because they're afraid of, you know, looking bad. They're afraid of what you're going to say. They're afraid of getting fired.
Right. No, it's tough.
And if you're not able to create that type of relationship with folks where you feel like they feel like they can come to you with problems, it makes it incredibly more difficult to kind of help people do their jobs. My job nowadays, when I started my career, my job was to build financial models. I haven't opened up Excel in maybe 12 years. Like I don't do that anymore, right? I always tell people across the organization, Both folks that report to me don't report to me. People that work in my org, I guess nowadays pretty much everybody does, but I always tell people my job is to essentially create the dynamics for you to be able to do your job well, right? And so that is, you know, it's like I can't sit here and tell you that I'm going to jump in and kind of do this transaction or be able to jump onto this system and do that. But if you come to me and you tell me it's like, hey, I need two people to do this or have an issue with that, then my job is to essentially make sure that you have the resources for you to be able to be successful at your job. And for me to figure out if you're actually using the right types of resources, right? Like I need to be able to understand your job well enough to know that if you're doing it efficiently or not.
Well, and for people not to be afraid to ask.
To ask.
You are very relatable. You're amazing. I want to thank you so much for being on this podcast. We're going to learn, you know, people are going to learn more about you and your journey, which, you know, is incredible. And thanks for being on the podcast.
You got it, John. You appreciate it.
Hi, John Schultz here. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. Would really appreciate it if you would like, comment, subscribe, and share with your friends. Looking forward to being with you soon.